It's the 10th of August, 1628. Great crowds have amassed on the shores of Stockholm Harbor to witness a magnificent event. The new flagship of the Swedish fleet, the Vasa, is preparing to set sail on its maiden voyage. Thousands of people from Stockholm and beyond have gathered here. Flags and banners flap in the breeze, and excitement grows among the spectators. The Vasa is the brainchild of Sweden's King Gustav Adolf. His vision of a grand warship more powerful than any other in the Baltic Sea has finally come to fruition. The crowd roars with approval as the Vasa cuts its lines and sets sail. As the Vasa sails away from its port, it fires one of its cannons as a salute to King Gustav Adolf, the Swedish Navy, and all on hand to witness this event. But within the hour, the Vasa would be no more. The story of the Vasa, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. The story of the Vasa goes back to 1523, when Gustav Eriksson became King Gustav I of Sweden. He was the first monarch from the Vasa family dynasty, and led Sweden into a period of reforms and growth. Most notably, he withdrew Sweden from the Hanseatic League. This was a commercial and political alliance between countries of Northern Europe. Withdrawing from the Hanseatic League allowed Sweden to achieve independent economic growth and prestige, which continued late into the 16th century. In 1587, Sigismund III, a grandson of Gustav I, became King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. 4 years later, he was named King of Sweden and Grand Duke of Finland, when his father, John III, died. Sigismund was staunchly Catholic, while Sweden was predominantly Protestant, making him a very unpopular and unwelcome monarch, prompting a civil war. In 1599, Sigismund III was deposed by his uncle, Charles IX, and when Charles died in 1611, his son, Gustav II Adolf, was crowned King of Sweden at just age 16. Sweden was in the midst of three separate wars, one with the Union of Denmark-Norway, another with Russia, and a third with Poland and Lithuania. Sweden's war with Denmark-Norway concluded in 1613, and Sweden was forced to pay a large sum for the return of two castles and six towns that had been captured. The war with Russia was more successful, ending in 1617. Russia was forced to renounce any claims to Latvia and Estonia, and was left without a port on the Baltic Sea. Sigismund III was the cousin of Gustav Adolf, and still reigned as monarch in Poland and Lithuania, and he desperately wanted Sweden back under his domain and the Catholic faith. He waged war against Sweden on and off between 1600 and 1629, and other Catholic kingdoms around Europe supported his claim. As a military commander, Gustav Adolf had earned the reputation as a brilliant tactician and strategist. His masterful use of artillery prompted 19th-century American military historian Theodore Dodge to call him the father of modern warfare. Some of Gustav's tactics are still studied by modern militaries. Gustav understood the threat Sigismund posed and poured much of his thought and money to the defense of his kingdom. Sweden's geographic position made it clear any invasion must come from the sea. Under King Gustav I, Sweden's navy had grown in number and firepower throughout the 16th century. But Gustav Adolf had inherited a fleet of smaller ships with single gun decks and shallower drafts. These ships were agile and ideal for protecting merchant ships in the Baltic Sea and through the dangerous shoals of Stockholm Harbor. In 1621, Gustav's army invaded and conquered the city of Riga of modern-day Latvia, and established it as a base of military operations for Sweden. This overseas outpost required regular transport of troops, weapons, and supplies by sea. His fleet of smaller ships were outgunned by his rivals in Denmark, Poland, and Lithuania, and with the additional possibility of being thrust into the 30 Years' War, Gustav Adolf required an upgraded, modern, powerful navy. In late 1624 and into 1625, the king formed a partnership with Dutchman Henrik Hibbertson, a master shipwright, and his business partner, Arent de Groot. The king had visions of a stunning, modern Swedish fleet that would show off the might of Sweden. Contracts were signed to build four ships, but two different contracts were signed, one by the Admiralty and one by the king himself. Each contract had slightly different measurements and specifications, starting the beginning of a long trail of confusion. The men got to work planning and carrying out Gustav's vision. Ultimately, four new warships were planned to be built over the next 4 years, two large ships of 135 feet and two smaller ships of 108 feet. Henrik Hibbertson ordered the timber and had it cut to size according to his plan. Before construction was underway, Gustav Adolf began a series of unfortunate meddling. In September of 1625, Sweden had lost 10 ships of its fleet in the Bay of Riga, a staggering loss. To quickly reinforce his navy, he changed his order to two medium-sized ships of 120 feet to be built on an accelerated schedule. Communicating with the king through Vice Admiral Klaus Fleming, Henrik Hibbertson refused. The lumber had already been cut for the two smaller ships, and nothing could be done. The keel of what would become the Vasa was laid down in the winter of 1626 at Skeppsgarden Navy Shipyard in Stockholm. The plan for the Vasa was a 135-foot warship with two gun decks. Warships with two gun decks already existed, but were not common at this time, and Hibbertson, although experienced, had never built one. With construction underway in 1626, Hibbertson became very ill and eventually bedridden. He was forced to hand over operations to his assistant shipwright, Henrik Jacobsen. Meanwhile, hundreds of craftsmen and laborers toiled 6 days a week throughout 1626 to complete the hull and masts. Mast makers, sailmakers, sawyers, turners, blacksmiths, carpenters, and other skilled tradesmen worked tirelessly from sunrise to sunset. Prisoners were even forced to work in the blacksmith shop, stoking the fires to keep the wheels of production churning. About half of the laborers at the shipyard were Swedes, with the other half coming from Denmark, the Netherlands, Estonia, Germany, and Finland. Some of the Samer nomadic people from the north even found work on the Vasa. As a result, language differences made communication difficult, and two different systems of measurement caused even further challenges. When it was discovered the seasonal foreigners were being paid almost double that of native Swedes, tensions mounted. The shipyard at Skeppsgarden was located on an island on what today is the Blasieholmen Peninsula. A guard was posted at the bridge to the island to monitor everyone who entered and departed the shipyard. After all, it was a military installation and security was vital. By March of 1627, construction of the hull was completed and the Vasa was launched. Around this same time, Henrik Hibbertson died of his illness and never had a chance to see his ship afloat. With the Vasa now launched, work on the stern castle and upper deck continued, and the ship was fitted out. Cloth for its 10 sails was ordered from Holland, along with hemp from Latvia for its rigging. The king ordered 72 lightweight 24-pound bronze guns from the Royal Gun Foundry in Stockholm, specifically for the Vasa. These were roughly half the weight of traditional 24-pounders, but in the confusing design alterations and changes in the construction schedule, the Vasa's second gun deck was built with port openings for 12-pound guns. Nevertheless, the Vasa's final armament consisted of 48 24-pound guns across the two gun decks, 8 3-pounders, 2 1-pounders, and 6 Sturmstycken, or howitzers, on the upper deck. At the time of its maiden voyage, 8 of the Vasa's 72 gun ports were vacant. The Vasa was an impressive warship, 226 feet long, 38 feet wide, and 172 feet tall from keel to the top of the main mast. It would be the most powerful ship in the Baltic at the time, and perhaps even the world. Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections: Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections: Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. Naval warfare during the 16th and early 17th centuries was primarily based on pulling alongside the enemy, boarding, and fighting in hand-to-hand combat with axes, pikes, and swords. It was preferable to capture enemy ships and add them to your own fleet, so blasting them apart with cannon was not desirable. The Swedish Navy, among others, viewed being captured as dishonorable and disastrous, preferring to blow up their own ships rather than let them be captured. A ship's crew must be quickly subdued in order to prevent such sabotage. As a result, roughly one-third of a warship's crew were mariners, and two-thirds were soldiers or marines. However, as an artilleryman, Gustav Adolf saw the future of naval warfare being conducted with a mass of guns firing broadsides. Grand ships of the line would indeed become standard practice, but the king was a generation ahead of his time. Ship-of-the-line battle formations were gradually developed in the mid-17th century by the British and Dutch. The Vasa was not only a formidable warship, but was a showpiece of Swedish might. Gustav Adolf wanted the Vasa to convey his power and essentially serve as an advertisement for the glory of Sweden. A virtual floating museum of art, the Vasa was decorated with bright colors of red, blue, yellow, and green, and featured over 700 sculptures. Roman leaders were depicted on either side of the bow, with a glorious 3-meter-long golden lion at the head of the prow, holding the Vasa family coat of arms in its paws. The coat of arms featured a bundle of wheat, going back to an ancient Roman symbol of leadership. Two golden lions holding the coat of arms are featured prominently on the transom, with biblical scenes of David and Gideon underneath, communicating that God was on the side of Sweden. All around the ship were sculptures from Greek and Roman mythology, the Old Testament, mermaids, monsters, and devils. Those seated on the ship's toilet at the front of the ship were treated to sculptures of their enemy, the Poles, being humiliated. In the summer of 1628, construction was behind schedule. King Gustav Adolf was hoping the Vasa would be ready for service by January of 1628, and he was growing anxious. But the shipbuilders and laborers were already growing worried about the ship's instability, even while berthed in port. Captain Sofring Hansen was overseeing the project for the Admiralty, and he too was concerned. To demonstrate the problem to Vice Admiral Klaus Fleming, he had 30 men run back and forth across the deck. Each time, the ship rolled in that direction, back and forth. Despite this alarming reality, Fleming ordered construction to continue, as he did not wish to further delay the ship's completion or inform the king of any further problems. The Vasa was loaded with 120 tons of ballast. Already, the ship's lower gun deck was closer to the water than desired. Any more, and the ship's gun ports would be dangerously close to the waterline. Finally, on the 10th of August, 1628, the Vasa was ready to set sail on its maiden voyage. On board were 125 sailors and 300 soldiers. It was a Sunday, and festivities started with church services. The ship was then warped, or hauled along by its anchor line, to the southern portion of Stockholm Harbor at Gamla Stan, near the Royal Palace, and the Storkyrkan Cathedral. Its orders were to sail to the southern port of Alvsnabben, where it would serve as the flagship of the Reserve Naval Force. The weather was calm, with only a slight breeze from the south. there was great fanfare among the men, women, and children in attendance, and excitement grew throughout the afternoon. Hundreds, possibly thousands of spectators lined the shores to watch the Vasa set sail, including the wives and children of the crew. Small private vessels were scattered around the harbor to get a view of the grand warship. King Gustav Adolf, however, was not in attendance, as he was tending to matters in Poland. Between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock p.m., the lines to the ship were cut, and four of the Vasa's sails were set. The pride of King Gustav II Adolf was finally underway. A booming cannon rang out, saluting the crowd and announcing its departure. But the wind was slight and could not fill the Vasa's sails, causing the ship to drift in the current. When a light gust caught the sails, it immediately caused the ship to heel badly to port, alarming everyone on board and the spectators on shore. The Vasa seemed in trouble as she struggled to slowly return to its upright position. Just then, as the ship passed a gap in the bluffs at Tegelviken, a stronger gust again pushed her over to port, but much further. Water poured in through the lower gun ports, to the horror of everyone watching. The formidable warship was sinking before their eyes. Captain Sofring Hansen immediately ordered the sails reefed and the gun ports closed. Vice Admiral Erik Janssen quickly ran to the gun decks to see if any of the guns came loose, which would cause the ship to list further to one side. The Vasa was sinking fast, and many of the crew threw themselves into the water and quickly swam away to prevent being sucked under. Those on the lower deck struggled in the chaos to find their way up the ladders to the main deck. Within just minutes, the Vasa sank in 32 meters of water, just 390 feet from shore. The tops of her masts were still visible above the water surface, enough for some of the men to hold on for their lives. Others floated on whatever debris they could find, while still more swam to shore. The Vasa was towing several small craft behind her, and some men made it into these boats and rescued others from the water. Her maiden voyage lasted only 45 minutes, traveling just 1,300 meters, less than a mile, from the shipyard. Captain Hansen waited until the very last moment to abandon his ship, almost too late. He was pulled under by the doomed ship, but managed to fight his way back to the surface. Vice Admiral Erik Janssen survived as well, but had a much closer brush with death. Janssen was below deck checking on the guns when the ship went down. As he tried to escape up a ladder, it collapsed and he was struck in the head by a loose hatch cover. Pulled from the wreckage and feared dead, Janssen slowly recovered. The original captain of the Vasa, Captain Hans Janssen, perished. While the vast majority survived the wreck, a total of 30 people lost their lives on the Vasa. A horrible sadness and grief overtook the city, followed by mourning and disbelief. But outrage and anger soon followed, as a search for answers began. Sweden's Privy Council sent a letter to Gustav the following day, finally arriving a week later. The king was furious. He sent his reply blaming, quote, imprudence and negligence as the cause of the sinking. The king made it perfectly clear that he wanted answers and someone to blame. In Stockholm, Captain Hansen was brought in for questioning. During his interrogation, he testified that all the guns were secured, none came loose, and he denied allegations of drunkenness among the crew. The council launched an official inquiry on the 5th of September, 1628. All of the surviving officers and crewmen were questioned, as well as the surviving shipwright, Henrik Jacobsen, and several other expert witnesses. The crewmen were grilled about conditions on the ship, including the rigging of the sails, positions of the guns, amount of ballast in the hold, as well as the sobriety of the crew and officers. The shipbuilders were questioned about the design of the ship, why it was built so narrow, why was it so top-heavy. Henrik Jacobsen testified that he continued the plan given to him by Henrik Hibbertsen, as directed by the king. In fact, he widened the ship an additional foot and a half. But the crew blamed the tradesmen, and vice versa. All the plans and specifications, armaments, and other details were dictated by and approved by the king himself, and nobody dared to even hint of blaming the king. When the inquiry concluded, nobody was found guilty for the sinking of the Vasa. With the original designer and shipbuilder Henrik Hibbertsen dead, blame was generally assigned to the unfortunate dead man.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
Many factors contributed to the sinking of the Vasa. Primarily, this was a time when ships were built without the use of advanced mathematics, such as calculus. No precise method of calculating load lines or buoyancy existed at the time, and discretion fell to the shipbuilder's experience. Ships were often built according to a previously accepted standard and then tested during sea trials. If the ship performed badly, it would undergo modifications until it was found to be seaworthy. Hibbertson had never built a ship this large before, or with such an arrangement of armament. Adding to the imprecise method of shipbuilding were the numerous changes thrown at the shipbuilders before construction began. With international laborers performing the work, it's easy to see how changes would be difficult to communicate and mistakes could be made. The Vasa became infamous throughout the centuries, and today we have the term Vasa syndrome in the business world to indicate communication failures and changes in plans causing a project to fail. King Gustav Adolf certainly shares some of the blame. His insistence on using the heavier 24-pound guns on the second gun deck caused even greater instability. Heavier guns, placed higher up from the waterline, causes a ship to be less stable. There is a long-standing belief among some historians that Gustav Adolf changed the design to add a second gun deck, or perhaps have the ship lengthened after construction began. Despite the king's meddling, no evidence has ever been found to prove this. Frederick Hawker, director of the Vasa Museum in Stockholm, stated, "The ship itself provides no evidence of substantial changes after construction began." Further complicating matters is the lack of documentation of the ship's specifications. Hibbertson seemingly planned the ship according to his usual design, although with an additional gun deck, and no detailed drawings, blueprints, or plans for the Vasa have ever been discovered. Simply put, the Vasa had too much of its weight above the waterline. Lacking proper ballast and being incapable of carrying more, the Vasa was too tall and too top-heavy to be stable. During its maiden voyage, the Vasa sailed with its gun ports open. Had Captain Hansen ordered the gun ports closed, it is likely the Vasa would not have sunk. Just 3 days after the sinking, arrangements were made to attempt to raise the flagship from the harbor bottom. English engineer Ian Bulmer managed to turn the ship upright, but in doing so, wedged it even further into the mud, where the ship remained stuck. Between 1663 and 1665, Albrecht von Treleben and Andreas Peckel attempted to recover the ship's guns. Using just a primitive diving bell, a team of Swedish and Finnish divers recovered over 50 of the ship's valuable bronze guns. The Vasa would be lost and forgotten, and then rediscovered several times throughout the centuries, and divers frequently visited the site of the wreck. In 1920, the fate of the Vasa almost went in an unfortunate direction. Brother Simon and Leonard Olshansky applied for a permit to blow up the wreck and use its waterlogged black oak to build furniture. Swedish authorities, however, rejected this plan and left the Vasa in place and undisturbed. In 1956, Swedish archaeologist Anders Fransson pinpointed the location of the Vasa using a homemade coring probe. Plans involving the Swedish Navy to raise the Vasa quickly got underway. A number of bizarre plans emerged, including filling the Vasa with ping pong balls, or freezing the Vasa into a giant ice cube that would float to the surface. these plans, not surprisingly, were dismissed. In the end, a more reasonable plan was accepted. For 2 years, divers dug tunnels underneath the ship through the mud using high-pressure water jets. This was extremely dangerous work. It is extremely cold at the bottom of the harbor, very dark, and visibility is poor. Divers also risked the tunnels collapsing on them, or the shifting of the wreck in any direction. Miraculously, no serious accidents occurred during their work. The ship was lifted by placing two pontoons parallel to each other on either side of the wreck, and the pontoons were filled with water to their maximum load. Steel cable slings from the pontoons were placed through the tunnels and under the ship. When secured, the pontoons were pumped out, raising the wreck gradually a few feet at a time as this process was repeated. In August and September of 1959, 18 lifts were performed, raising the Vasa to 16 meters below the surface, and it was moved to a safer section of the harbor where divers could perform their work. Finally, on the 24th of April, 1961, the Vasa emerged after spending 333 years underwater and stuck in the mud. Television cameras, photographers, and thousands of spectators looked on as the raising of the centuries-old ship made international news. Much like the day of its sinking, its recovery was witnessed and celebrated by thousands. The Vasa was carefully pumped free of water and mud and placed in dry dock on a concrete pontoon. The Vasa was in remarkably good condition considering the amount of time it spent underwater. The cold waters protected the wooden hull and masts from the highly destructive mollusk Teredo navalis, or shipworms. However, the iron nails and other hardware quickly disintegrated within just a few years of sinking. Storms, strong currents, erosion, and damage caused by humans also left their marks. From 1961 to 1988, the Vasa was housed at a facility named the Vasa Shipyard. As archaeologists and curators worked to excavate and restore the ship, the public could visit and get a glance of the work. The ship had to be routinely sprayed to prevent it from drying out too fast and cracking. This spraying and drying out period would last for decades. But its temporary facility was small and cramped, and not suitable for a working museum. The Swedish government wanted a permanent facility for its famed ship and launched a design competition for a new facility which could serve as a museum for the public and a place for archaeologists to carry out their work. Swedish architects Monson and Dahlbach won the competition, and ground was broken on the facility in 1987. The Vasa was moved to the site at the Vasa Museum in December of 1988, and archaeologists and museum workers have painstakingly cared for and restored the ship to its beauty. The Vasa remains at the Vasa Museum in Stockholm and is one of the biggest tourist attractions in all of Sweden and the world. That's going to do it for the story of the Vasa. Thank you so much for listening. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs at ShipwrecksPod on social media or at ShipwrecksandSeaDogs.com. Official merchandise is available on the website, so check it out, buy a shirt, help support the show. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on YouTube at SeanSecret or on the web at sean.siegfried.se. If you want to hear ad-free versions of the show, you can subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com/shipwreckspod. Please join me again for a new episode in 2 weeks. And until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.